This is an ABC podcast.
Pick up a paintbrush, a photograph, a pen. Where do you begin?
The start of them is in a photograph or in a sketch, both, but then it's kind of let go of as well.
You know, people who haven't been making art for a while, they can be really afraid of starting and just trying to show them, like, just to start, it doesn't matter, just attack it.
This is The Art Show. I'm Daniel Browning, coming to you today from Minjungbul country on the far north coast of New South Wales, where we say Jingiwala, hello. Does an artwork begin with an idea or an image? We'll soon step inside the studio of a landscape painter with a fluid sense of place.
And it's that new place, I suppose, that I'm really trying to find. Somewhere I've departed to that I'm not sure where I'm going.
And hear from the architect whose very materials deal with absent stories.
This silence or this absence is still a thing. It relates to a thing that we know existed, a thing that we know could exist again. Simply put, you know, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence.
Plus, the artist who believes in drawing badly. It's all coming up here on The Art Show. The song Nolishwa by the South African jazz singer Dorothy Masuka from 1952. She's one of the women at the centre of an exhibition called And She Was Wearing Trousers, a call to our heroines. Two curators are behind this show. They've enlisted contemporary artists from Southern Africa and the diaspora. But they've also gone on a quest into the archives, where the poetry, music and activism of trailblazers who fought apartheid and led kingdoms lies buried. Figures like Kretowa, who negotiated between her Khoi people and Europeans. And it begs the question, how do we truly decolonise the art gallery if it insists on the separation of visual art from music, song and poetry? Roberta Joy Rich and Naomi Villapi, welcome to The Art Show. And She Was Wearing Trousers, the title of the exhibition, comes from the song by Dorothy Masuka. What's that lyric mean, Roberta?
So, And She Was Wearing Trousers is an English translation of a Dorothy Masuka song named Nolishwa. She's more well known as Masuka because of the way her name was recorded in archives. But basically, this song speaks about this woman who goes about town and she's wearing trousers. So I guess it's very much of a time when this track was released. And also the track speaks about how she has many boyfriends, but we love her anyway. And we just thought this was a really quite telling and specific nod to a feminist discourse, but also something that sits within African feminism and archives as well.
I have noticed that Dorothy Masuka and Masuka, I saw a video of Dorothy performing at Winnie Mandela's funeral and noticed Masuka and Masuka, and I was, what does it mean? Why the difference between the Masuka and Masuka?
I think Roberta kind of alluded to it, but essentially she was, you know, born Dorothy Masuka. My dad's from Zimbabwe, and another friend, Santi, they both are like, yes, it's Dorothy Masuka. But then as a recording artist, she was originally from Rhodesia, and when she moved to South Africa, that's where her career really sort of took off. And as a recording artist, they just spelt her name wrong. And that just kind of ended up being how she was known. And I guess with everything at play, she just didn't have a chance to change it. So it kind of stuck. Born Dorothy Masuka, like stage name Dorothy Masuka.
Thanks for clarifying that. The heroines you've highlighted in this exhibition were politicians, artists, extraordinary figures like Kretowa, activists against colonial armies, racial segregation, and even the patriarchy. How did you want to engage with their stories?
Yeah, I think when we were looking at this idea of what our archives are, and Naomi and I had visited the local libraries in Melbourne, and we wanted to see, I guess, what we might find in a library that speaks to our histories. And of course, we were mostly finding books on either Mugabe or Mandela. And so we were drawn to these specific women as a kind of entry point into trying to understand our identity, but also relationship and connection with the Southern African region. And we selected these kind of women based on different moments. I mean, I think it was 2019 when Naomi and I were still developing this project and Dorothy had just passed away. Other figures like Princess Kratoa had come up in conversations with family when I was visiting in South Africa, where they were thinking about renaming the Cape Town International Airport after her. But this was the first time I'd ever heard someone like Kratoa's name. So these women have a very, I guess, silenced and contentious nature in the way that they're recorded. And we felt like this is a kind of beginning point to explore their histories, but also unpack our own.
Now, Dorothy Masuku, born Dorothy Masuku, what a powerhouse. And Santila Chingapi, the journalist, says in the program to the exhibition that according to family legend, she met Dorothy when she was a baby. Just tell me about Dorothy.
Like, so a lot of these women are a bit of an enigma. And I think for us in our research, we found that she was a real talent that was kind of overshadowed by the likes of people like Miriam Makeba and some of those bigger African artists that sort of, you know, had a lot of international recognition. I guess a little fun fact is that she actually wrote the original version of Pata Pata, which Miriam Makeba ended up becoming quite well known for. But her and Miriam were really sort of great friends, do you know what I mean? It wasn't kind of, it was that it was particularly competitive from what I've sort of found. And I think that they really relished in those years that there was a lot of success for them sort of in the late 50s into the 60s and then beyond. As sort of Santi says in her art piece for us, she kind of had this lovely personal encounter with her family. And I think, yeah, my dad alludes to this. He's like, you know, you can find Masukus in our village. And I'm like, okay. Yeah. There's sort of this, I think, real, she was very well loved. And someone who was also known to be staunch and politically charged, and I think at one point was in exile at around the same time that Miriam was. And for us, I think we only really scratched the surface on, you know, kind of understanding her character and her career.
Now, the Melbourne-based musician and artist Rara Zulu has composed a sound installation to Dorothy. How did that work come about, and what did you propose to her, or was it the other way around? Did the offer come for this sound installation first?
Part of our development process was that we invited Rara to join Naomi and I to listen to some of these women that we were exploring. So there was Dorothy Masuku, but also Brenda Fassi. And Rara, obviously being a vocalist and a musician herself, listening to these women that she listened to as a, in her childhood, but also just within the sound and music of Southern Africa. We kind of wanted the artists that we invited to gravitate towards, I guess, the individuals or elements that they resonated more so with. And so when we were listening to music by both artists, Rara was quite attracted to the song of Nolishwa and this kind of idea of a woman being, I guess, like a kind of dandy, but an appropriation of that and of her being quite free and fluid. And we kind of hear it in the lyrics of the song as well. So it's very much a kind of homage, but also a, I guess, a present day look at what Nolishwa could be.
So there must be a lot of conversation between the African continent and diaspora communities here to make an exhibition like this, to bring it to life. What were those conversations like and who were they with?
Yeah, there are a number of conversations. I guess a lot of this was developed in sort of peak lockdowns and things like that in Melbourne. So we sort of started in sort of late 2019 talking to artists in sort of Southern Africa that we already knew, including Black Banana, Javinani Newman, also another collective called Breaking Bread, who'd actually just presented at the Biennale in Sydney. And Yeah, we were just sort of talking about various things. The sort of idea of Pacific women was still a very early kind of idea. And I guess over that time, our relationships really developed. What we found was our ideas were so expansive about how we wanted to connect the continent and how we wanted to connect with peers. And these women felt like a really great vessel to do that. This is like really just the beginning, I think. A lot of us have been, we had a public program last week where we did some conversations, and I think it's just sort of the start of a growing kind of space and community where we can continue to talk about ideas of place and identity through different topics, I guess.
Now, Brenda Fassi was an incredible performer and activist known as the queen of African pop in the 80s. She's in the work of Nonsikelelo Matiti, and there's also a video of Brenda Fassi that you can watch. What is it about Brenda Fassi that you needed to draw attention to?
Brenda has become such a massive icon in South African culture, but I think also, I mean, it's such a shame Brenda passed away at a very young age of 39 some time ago. But her music was the highest selling records in the South African nation in the peak of her time. And tracks that we... that Nonsikelelo Mutiti's work referred to, Mimeza, was one of her highest selling albums and tracks. But Mimeza, it means to call out or to cry. And throughout this exhibition, we've been exploring themes of call and response, or how these women in their own ways call upon their communities, whether it be through song, whether it be through literal kind of strategic navigation of missionaries or armed forces. And so Brenda and this song in Crying Out was quite fitting, and it's who Nonsi gravitated towards working about. So the work that wraps around Arts House features Nonsi's unique typography that she has created as a part of her arts practice, that features braids and a cornrow motif. And these, each window spells out the letters of Mimeza and also encapsulates Brenda Fassi's gestures, clapping, caressing, gesticulating and holding the microphone. These gestures are kind of a ode to, but also a kind of response to the gestures of Black women and Black women within a liberation. And so we see these kind of archival images merged in with Nonsi's typography.
Now, as a black fellow, I'm a bit cynical, but it seems that we've entered a kind of age where there's a reckoning with the exclusion of black artists and black stories from museums and galleries. There's still a strict categorization of art, I think, in Western culture that separates music from poetry, from dance and visual art. It keeps them all quite separate, which is not a problem in Indigenous Australian culture. We don't really separate them. But as far as you guys see it, is that categorization, because we were talking about artists who were recording, who were singing, and yet we're seeing them visually as well. Is that categorization a problem, do you think?
I think so. I think it's very much a symptom of, I guess, the Western canon of art production, but even just of Western society. I mean, I'm sure Naomi as a producer, but myself as an artist, you know, we work within these industries, and often, you know, it's kind of like the visual artists are here, the musicians are here, and the performers are here, and it's very separate. And it felt extremely necessary for Naomi and I to have a multidisciplinary approach, because yeah, these practices are all intertwined and interwoven and speak to one another. But when I feel like when we're, I guess, navigating today, it's very, yeah, things become separated very quickly. And so even in explaining what this project was to some people, it's like, okay, so you have film, but you also have music. Like, it just made a lot of sense for us to weave in these narratives and experiences because they go together hand in hand, but also speak to the nuances and complexities of a Black experience, you know, whether that be one that is of an African Indigenous person, or I think within this context, there are a lot of parallels that we just felt like working in this way made sense. I don't know if you want to add anything, Naomi.
Some of the choices were quite deliberate to sort of push up against some of those silos that sort of exist, I think, within the arts. We also kind of the context of Arts House generally being more of a performance sort of oriented venue sort of got us thinking about what would really work in that space. So the Afro diaspora artists from Australia are all rooted in sort of performance. So Rara's a musician, Kirsty is a performer and playwright, and Tururo is a spoken word artist and performer. I guess it's sort of some of the limitations around pandemic and things, but the artists on the continent are generally more visually based. But I think it's kind of interesting because I think there's so many new opportunities because of the reckoning and things like that for Black artists, and how we move through these spaces, how we choose to kind of absorb the opportunities, I think is really kind of interesting, just seeing the different pathways for the different artists that we've been talking to as well. I hope that we can kind of create something that is truly, I mean, for us, it's just, I feel like it's just about telling a story and knowing that there's many layers to this story and many ways that people want to take it in. And that includes music, sound, you know, text, you know, all the movement, or like a live performance. All those elements are really key to making sure that people sort of understand the message, I guess.
And She Was Wearing Trousers, A Call to Our Heroines, is on at Melbourne's Arts House until August the 6th. And this is Rara Zulu's piece, Nolly, which is in the form of a multi-channel sound installation. This is The Art Show on ABC RN. You're with me, Daniel Browning. She gonna get this Monday. She gonna get a bite. Stare into a painting by the seascape artist Miche Bolter, and you might recognise a scene that is unmistakably of Lutruwita, Tasmania. Looking out from the Land's Edge, Miche's twilight skies and solemn bays are set at that magical liminal hour. But whether we're looking at a day breaking or dusk falling is in the eye of the beholder. The Art Show's Rosa Ellen visited the artist at her Hobart studio in Salamanca Place and found out some surprising details about those misty atmospheric landscapes.
My name's Miche Bolter, and I'm a painter from Tasmania, and I've been painting for a really long time. Landscapes, seascapes, kind of on the edge of land. This is my studio at Salamanca Art Centre.
What is this building?
It used to be an old jam factory, and it's, you know, kind of had various lives, but it kind of got inhabited by a group of artists, and it's sort of slowly become a little more formalised with actual barriers and sort of, you know, little studios, and it's managed by the Salamanca Arts Centre. And there's lots of different shops and kind of studios around here, which is, it's great because we've sort of all got our own privacy, and yet we can kind of socialise with each other. There's a puppet theatre here, and there's, you know, there's a theatre company as well, and kind of different shops and galleries, and all kind of Tasmanian. So it has a very strong kind of policy around keeping it Tasmanian. There's a strong feeling of solidarity among Tasmanian artists. That's the feeling I've gotten so far.
I know. It's a little, we're all kind of, you know, pretty proud of our place. But yeah, I mean, it's also important, I think. And the Arts Centre does try to bring in, you know, they do bring in other artists and so forth. I mean, it's not, we don't want to be too insular in what we're doing here. So, you know, it's all about showing and sharing.
We're standing in front of one of your works. It's a really large oil painting of that edge of land looking out into the ocean, as you were telling me. Where is it? Where are all your landscapes?
Yeah, they're kind of they're of place and not of place. There is reference photographs and there's kind of bits and pieces, but they are essentially imaginary, and they have kind of origins in experience, but at the same time the other part of the experience is painting them and being in the studio and how they kind of evolve. So they're taken as a starting point, the place, I suppose, which are places that I've lived in or I've spent a lot of time in, you know, essentially southern Tasmania. That's Bruny Island, or kind of, in this case, Research Bay, Cockle Creek area down the southern part of Tasmania. And they're really fairly indescript kind of places. They've become more and more kind of indescript, I think, in the sense of being removed from the particulars of a place and more of an imagined landscape.
You always use these sort of smoky blues and rosy hues. Is it the break of dawn or is it dusk? Is there a time in them?
And I'm kind of okay if that's also a little hard to pin down. I guess essentially Tasmania has a lot of low light. I mean, winter, it can be all day, as you've probably experienced today. And it's just a kind of... it's atmospheric, and that's the kind of quality that allows me to let certain landforms dissolve or others to kind of catch the light and to kind of envelop the self in the place and lend itself to a certain feeling, I suppose.
Did you clean up your studio before I arrived?
How did you guess? Not entirely, but a little bit, yes.
Yeah. I'm used to more mess in painters' studios.
Oh, there you go.
But thank you. The listener will have no idea. When you begin a work, is there a real life, is there a sketch, is there something in nature that you start by putting to the canvas, or is it something in your mind that you're kind of summoning?
A little bit of both. I mean, I've sort of over...
Let's walk over here.
There's kind of a, you know, massive kind of photographs that have just accumulated over the years, and sometimes they're kind of pieced together or kind of drawn on and sort of pulled out of their context, of their original context, I suppose. And so, yeah, the start of them is kind of in a photograph or in a sketch, both, but then... it's kind of let go of as well, you know, at certain points, and then kind of, you know, I'll get myself completely lost in the painting and return to that and realize that there's nothing to return to. I've now gone somewhere else. And it's that new place, I suppose, that I'm really trying to find. I'm still trying to find a place that is both of its original source and of somewhere I've departed to that I'm not sure where I'm going.
You spent some of your childhood living on a boat, is that right?
Yeah, I did. I had very adventurous parents with fairly unconventional sort of career ideas, lifestyle ideas, I suppose. My parents are Canadian. They built a boat here in Australia, and when my sister and I were just little babes, they set sail for Canada. And so I had a lot of my formative child years on a small boat, sort of in the middle of the ocean. And I know those experiences, which, you know, later on in my adult years, I reflected back on as being particularly extraordinary and illuminating in ways that has
you know, really gone on to kind of become part of my practice, to reflecting back, as well as sort of finding myself living in places that are by the sea or experiences that are on the water. It was a really small boat. It was Mum and Dad built it, 32 foot, and essentially we sailed to Canada and lived in Canada for some years before sailing back again.
Well, there's a very intimate quality to the water that you're painting. Must be buried pretty deep in your brain.
yeah. I know it's not always that sort of foreboding sense. It's kind of it is almost a domestic thing. It's almost part of the foliage or the sky or the sea is part of the landscape, a huge part of the landscape as far as my perception of the world goes. My palette and the way I work is all very subtle and very gradual, and so shifts do happen slowly and things evolve slowly and I work slowly and the layers of paint build up over time.
How long would it take you to make one of these works that we're standing in front of?
I actually find it really difficult to work to short sort of deadlines, so it's really great when I'm just given free rein for a year to work towards an exhibition, and then I can kind of let them all evolve in their own pace and their own way. And so I work on them kind of, I usually have about four on the go at once, or at this stage now I've kind of got more on the go when I'm doing the smaller works as well. And, you know, like sometimes they just need kind of half an hour's work just to put a little, you know, put a glaze over something, and then you have to let that dry, and it's middle of winter and paint's drying really slowly. You know, it can take months and months is the answer. And then there's also that time where you know it's not right, but you don't know what to do. And so turning its back to the wall, you know, turning it to the wall, giving yourself that opportunity to look again can just...
Oh, really, like you just turn it, you turn away from it. Yeah.
Yeah, I turn away because, you know, I mean, there's a big... You know, the ego part of you wants to resolve it right then and there and go home and go, yay, wow, I've done a painting today. But that's just not the reality of the way I work. Well, we'll go back to this big one because this guy's really not right. And it's sort of lacking a lot of colour. And a lot of the time the colour comes for me in the glazing. So it's sort of, we'll put white back into it, and it's kind of, that's why it's a bit sort of whitish at the moment until I kind of can glaze some more colour into it.
Those layers I can see now that this actually doesn't have as much depth as that one, that work.
Yeah. And I mean, you can see sort of this is still just the raw canvas coming through because...
Oh, so it is. It's just sketched in, yeah.
Just sketched in. So, you know, in effect, I've really just painted around that form, not actually the form, because I do want to keep some of that light in. And once you've taken that light that comes from the back of the canvas, once you paint over that, it's hard to kind of get that richness back again.
Walking over to the ledge where you have your smaller works lined up, there's no middle ground. You're either like really, really big, like half a wall sort of big, or really small. These are done on board, whereas there's a stretched canvas behind us.
Yeah, that's something I've allowed myself to do this exhibition, which is... Yeah, you're right. There's lacking that middle size, which I've always struggled with. Somehow, if I'm trying to paint intimacy and distance, size really does affect that. And if something's big, it's kind of got an enveloping quality to it and its sort of presence. Whereas smaller work, and this work all on boards here, is kind of, you know, coming right down to sort of fairly small little kind of landscapes within landscapes that are kind of 15 centimetres.
This is an interesting trick. I better describe it. You have a landscape and then a small sort of square within the picture, which is actually, I don't know if it's of a different landscape, but it's certainly from a different perspective. Could be like you're looking into a window or perhaps a viewfinder almost. Yeah, it's a really interesting effect. When did you start using this?
It's actually just this work. I've just started using that. And really it is as you describe, it's about trying to sort of come into something, kind of enclose it, or that intimacy of something small and imagined that kind of carries itself into the wider world. And they're almost kind of thinking paintings. They're paintings about a process of thinking and imagining revealed a little more than in the larger works, which tend to be of, you know, a complete landscape that sort of holds itself together. These ones are almost pulling them apart, you know. It's what's behind those representational landscapes. What's the thinking behind that? And then that's where these little works come from.
They're kind of like painters' paintings. I mean, because but behind us we have these spectacular, really these big canvases that are sort of at this like interesting kind of liminal state. You're not sure if it's dawn or dusk. But here you're kind of getting into the real questions of painting, of looking and viewing. I'm quite curious as to how you kind of get to this mental state. Like, you're working purely from your imagination. Do you listen to music? Do you need silence?
We're in an art centre, as I said before, so there are times when, you know, it's never silent. It's actually really quiet today on characteristically. So sometimes listening to music is just actually a practical way of just in giving myself a little bit of internal space, because it's otherwise quite dominating. But look, I do listen to music sometimes, but other times I just prefer not to have any, you know, to try and get the feeling out of the work rather than the music. There's a lot of just making that's involved without too much preconception, and then your pieces will, because they're kind of paired together, which I know looks kind of quite different to the larger work, but they actually work together.
Michelle Bolter, thank you so much for taking me through your studio here at Salamanca Place.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for coming. It's fantastic. Good to have you.
Michelle Bolter speaking with producer Rosa Ellen. Her next exhibition is in November at Art House Gallery in Sydney. Staying in Nipaluna, the artist Tom O'Hearn makes anarchic, bold ink drawings. Hobartians will be familiar with his artwork. His murals adorn many public buildings in the city, including more than 30 toilet blocks. His most recent exhibition, Bum Steer, was produced over several months that he spent on a mysterious secret island. Tom has taught a class called How to Draw Badly, and it relates to a firmly held belief that good drawing can be bad and vice versa.
So I guess it was sort of a joke. I guess I'm thinking about what other people think of as bad rather than what I think of as bad. So it's not necessarily defining what's bad drawing so much as just questioning what's good drawing.
So I know this invitation to draw badly is a bit of a joke, but you say that we all drew. It's one of those things that we did when we were kids, but some of us just stopped doing it. So there's something innate about drawing as far as you can see.
Yeah, I think it's really innate. I think it's really built into us. And I think you give people pens and they start drawing. It's almost like it's written into us a little bit, the way we draw, you know. I had to have it pointed out to me, but I always start with an eyeball and then work my way out. And I think a lot of people work a similar way, like it's almost written into our hands. And then at some point, you know, that innateness gets sort of beaten out of people with self-consciousness, which has happened to me in all other aspects of my life. But with drawing, I seem to be able to not pay attention for some reason.
Yeah, you're not a bad drawer at all. You're a brilliant drawer. And there's also...
cheers.
When you started drawing, well, my opinion is actually that drawing is a pure art form. Where do you stand on that? Whether, you know, we don't need to paint, we don't need to do things in oils. We can draw and that's enough.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still trying to do things in paint and oils and stuff. I'm constantly trying to do that, but drawing is enough, and there is something just so immediate about it. Just bleeds out of your hands, just pictures coming, and you don't have to build it up. You don't need any sort of special materials or anything. You only need something, one colour and something another colour, and you can make a picture of something.
Now tell me about these classes that you teach.
I had taught a bad drawing class at Salamanca Art Centre a couple of weeks ago. And I guess there's sort of two things that I was sort of thinking about was one that, you know, people who haven't been making art for a while, they can be really reserved and afraid of starting and just trying to show them, like, just to start, it doesn't matter, like, just attack it. And then for the artists that have been working for ages, like, there's this sort of paradox of, like, all their experience sort of closes them off to, or I find closes me off sometimes to new things, to new directions and new possibilities or whatever. So, you know, using drawing badly on purpose or without any sense of outcome, like just drawing for the sake of drawing to sort of unlock new things and without any sort of expectation or pressure of it becoming anything good or knowing what the answer is already. Like seeing what happens, you know.
And we're Australians. We also love to put ourselves down, like the self-deprecating humour in learning how to draw badly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely hit a nerve. That particular class, everyone who came was actually really good at drawing. It's sort of a pressure when you become really good at something. Like spend a lot of time trying to learn how to draw, you know, inverted commas correctly. And I just got to a point where became something I wanted to break down and pull apart and find something else. Like if I think of it in terms of music, like, you know, a song doesn't get better if it goes for longer, or like if you fit more notes into it, it doesn't make it any good, any better or anything. Like it might be rubbish to listen to. Like there's something else, like something a bit slipperier that you're trying to catch a hold of, I think.
And what's your preferred medium when it comes to drawing? I mean, ink? Do you use Sharpies? What kind of mediums do you use?
I'm still looking for it. I don't know. I've got this idea of a perfect pen, and so I'm constantly like pulling pens apart and refilling them with different paint and thinners and then chopping up the end of the pen to make it try and work. I'm still looking for this perfect medium, but like I guess that's the thing, like searching for it. And I feel like each medium's got its own sort of ideas already written in it. If you pick up a particular paintbrush, it's going to go and it's in a way that, not that it wants to go, but it does feel like it wants to go somewhere. I have to mix my mediums up a lot, otherwise I get bored.
So not Conti crayons, that's what I used when I was at art school, or charcoal.
Ah, yeah, I just found some crayons the other day and picked them up. And it's like, oh, why haven't I been using these? Like they're just the greasy and that flow that just keeps going. I always feel like if you pick up a medium that doesn't just keep flow, I'm really impatient. You get these like really dry mediums that just don't want to go, and you have to like fight it across the page. Like I just lose interest. I want something that's like can sort of move as fast as I'm thinking, like just moving across the page and going any direction it wants to go.
Which is, you know, it's a barrel of laughs, if nothing else. But seeing the way that you work and some of your short videos, is a hilarious video. It's oddly hilarious video of you, and you've created a set of gloves, and you've used, I think, what text is or Sharpies. I'm not quite sure what your medium is there, but you've created a set of gloves and you're in a mask and you've with your back to us in this massive sheet of paper, but you created this absolutely beautiful drawing.
Oh, cheers. Yeah, and it was just sort of automatic. It's like it's written into those gloves. Just random things I had lying around the studio. I'm trying to use everything I've got in the studio before I buy too many new things. And I was looking at these gloves and looking at the sticky tape and looking at the pens, and it was just like, oh, okay. And I've got this massive piece of paper that has been sitting in the corner forever getting eaten by silverfish, so I might as well make something with it. It's sort of sort of fun. I'd love to do really huge works like that and get even more, like maybe get shoes with textures on them and, I don't know, maybe some sort of one that comes out of my nose, like Mr. Squiggle or something.
Tom O'Hearn there, and you can see some of his work on his Instagram accounts, including the video where he channels Freddy Krueger and Edward Scissorhands. His handle is Tom O'Hearnia. Thanks for your company here on The Art Show. It's not often I think mind blown when I'm talking to artists or anyone for that matter, but that's what happened when I spoke to my next guest, who moves pretty freely across art forms. He grew up in Redfern in inner Sydney, and he's Wiradjuri, and I first heard him co-host a podcast about gentrification. His name is Joel Sherwood-Spring, And his most recent work is a series of heaving concrete sculptures set up on easels, which bear the traces of what could be trees, the explosive fuel that powered the devastating 2019 bushfires. He's created a visual record of loss, not of the trees, but of traditional fire management practices, just one aspect of what Joel calls a 700-generation-long design project. So let's meet him. He's on his laptop in a very busy spot, in a very busy part of the world right now.
Apologies for all of the traffic. I'm at the entranceway to our dormitory.
It's atmospheric.
Yeah, exactly. I'm in the accessway. I'm currently living in the Friedrichshafen Museum, which is the kind of central museum building in Kassel, Germany. What I've heard recently, it is the oldest public exhibition space, obviously in the Western world. I don't know how it tracks globally. But yeah, we are here participating in a project run by Good School, who are a pedagogical collective that work with Raumgruppe, who are the curators of Documenta 15, which is why we are here in Kassel, Germany, living in the museum.
You describe your practice as multidisciplinary, but you train in something quite different. You refer to yourself as an artist, but what's your background?
Often I've spoken about, listening to other artists describe themselves as multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary, and I've kind of started sort of framing the practice in which I work in as sort of anti-disciplinary.
I thought I heard you say anti-disciplinary.
Yeah, so my background, my training has come through architecture. So I've studied in the architecture program in various institutions across Sydney, but also internationally. I've finished both, a kind of full coursework degrees. I have a master's in architecture. But these days I sort of focus more directly in sort of arts-focused programming and research, as well as kind of more educational, pedagogical frameworks and stuff. So I teach and also sort of work in a artist-run initiative known as PARI, which is based in Western Sydney.
Yeah, so that idea of anti-disciplinary is interesting because then it means you can move freely across those disciplines, if you like to call them that. I don't particularly like the word discipline, but it's kind of presenting a kind of an ethical position, really.
Precisely. Yeah, no, exactly. So for me, coming up in teaching in architecture and studying architecture, thinking of the ways in which that kind of comes to ground for me and the things that I'm interested in, a lot of the conversations I want to have are well before a building is built. Well before materials are extracted and well before even a design can be done. The things that I am really interested in is, and maybe this is less me sort of showing off my own nerd tendencies in some way, but I'm much more interested in the ways in which we create contracts and the way that we recognize particular actors on land within the context of Southeast Australia, but also, the wider kind of nation and then that kind of narratives connected to that. So for me, a big part of it is what is left unaddressed, what is the stuff that's sort of buried beneath the disciplines of art and architecture and that sort of research that can kind of sit in between. So, yeah. That's why I sort of frame it as anti-disciplinary, because so much of what I care about happens before that.
We should say that you're one of the artists curated into Ceremony, the National Indigenous Art Triennial curated by Hedy Perkins. So you've created work for that, and I was always intrigued by the concept because I heard about it some time ago. And of course, Ceremony was delayed due to the pandemic. Tell me about the work that you've created for Ceremony.
They are nine 2.4-meter tall sculptures that are arranged facing one another. They're constructed through a process of harvesting timber that's needed to be felled or has been felled in the process of land management, particularly traditional fire practice, in which then those trees themselves are laid into formwork and concrete poured over them. Then, once the concrete has dried, the timbers have been burnt out from the sculptures themselves, leaving the imprints or impressions, negatives of the trees themselves.
Conceptually, what's that about, this idea of absence?
My practice for a long time has sort of been drawn towards thinking through this particular feeling of absence that I think is shared not only with the people I live directly with, so my family, but many other Indigenous Australians. And this absence is a thing, right? It's an object. It's an object that we navigate around in our daily lives, in our cultural lives, and the way that we engage with our histories. So I'm always very interested in the sort of like object nature of this absence and how it is something that we kind of can all relate to and locate in our own ways. But it's also maybe kind of counter to sort of a Western idea of sort of absence or silence in particular in relationship to the NGA work for ceremony, is that this silence or this absence is still a thing. It relates to a thing. A thing that we know existed, a thing that we know could exist again. So in that sense, I guess kind of simply put, you know, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. So the sort of play with that at a tectonic level, like at a material level for the sculptures, is obviously created through the laying of these timbers that are being harvested from bushfire affected areas, trees that need to be cut down.
When you say absence, I think of loss, but you think of it much more generatively. You think of it constructively. This absence is a space where things happen.
Definitely. I think loss is also a part of it. I don't think it's a simple concept in which it could operate in any sort of binary. I think because it is an ongoing part of a living in the Australian context today as an Indigenous person, I think that absence, that loss is 100% affecting. But the ways in which it has affected us and the ways in which we can talk about it, I think, is still generative. I think it's to point to the fact that a language, a practice, an ecosystem that bore it may no longer be present, but that doesn't mean it won't be again.
So Joel, I guess I'll put it to you like this. It sounds like you're in PhD mode.
Yeah. I've definitely been writing about some of these practices and ideas in very kind of still finding the way to sort of navigate the kind of clunky academic language. And so forgive me if I'm sounding a little bit inaccessible at times. Some of the devices in my mind when I think about this are pretty complicated and sort of nested within each other. So I feel like I have to sort of unpack a lot to describe my thinking. The work at the NGA is really about this kind of common thread in which I felt, yes, we'd talk about the bushfires for some time, and yes, there would be some interest in the sort of cultural aspects of burning for different Indigenous groups in affected areas. But really what was not being addressed was this sort of very old problem that we have not only in Australia, but I think kind of globally, which is about sort of disempowering the dead. Because disempowering the dead is still kind of so important to the implementation of the sort of extractive practices. And we can kind of see that located in the bushfires when we talk about post and pre, and this need or this nostalgia for a place that wasn't burnt when, you know, there is no balance in nature. It's evidenced very clearly in the kind of problems that have been created once Indigenous practices were removed from the land, right? It's always been an active engagement. But this was sort of felt like it was going to be cementing this idea that we'd sort of lost this thing, something that we couldn't return to or that we couldn't get back or that we couldn't actively engage in trying to make better.
I always talk about the contemporaneity of the past. In order to try to make other people understand where I'm coming from and why my relationships with my ancestors are present and living and contemporary, is that the past is contemporaneous with the present. How do we ever divorce ourselves from the past? Because that's impossible. It defines everything. It doesn't define the future, but it definitely makes the present what it is.
I just feel like things are being, at times, can be oversimplified into good, bad, loss, done, over, when there's so much to be learnt from these things that can return us to thinking about the past and how it creates this present moment.
Joel, I first heard you on a podcast which you presented with another person I'm a huge admirer of, Lorna Munro, and you were talking about the built environment, about the kind of, I guess, uneasy relationship that a lot of us urban blackfellas have with the built environment. And I'm thinking of the handprint or the ideas or the intellectual power of our ancestors created all these environments in their own distinct ways, talking even just about the roads around Sydney, for instance, is just an example.
Yeah, and like settlement patterns were largely defined at the very beginning through resistance, you know, like literally blackfellas fighting for their land dictated the ways in which people could live and grow and create farms as colonizers, as trying to extract natural resources. Within the context of Survival Guide with Lorna, we took the very lived, very real experiences that we were having at the time, both growing up in Redfern, living on the block, going to Murrawina, like living in the material, like the actual spaces that were produced by the 1960s, 1970s, like political revolution of Redfern. And these were the spaces that we were politicized in, actively watching those places be gentrified in the times between 2015 to 2020. And so that there are these relationships to past and present that are evidenced in our built environments in many different ways. Coming back to the conversation about the PhD, I'm currently doing research on the sort of material archives of the Sydney Living Museum network, paying particular attention to the Hyde Park Barracks, where we're looking, or personally I'm looking at the histories of the appropriation of shell middens, so vast networks of shell that were built up over tens of thousands of years by Gadigal mob and mob all up the south and north, like east, southeast coast and further north all the way up, and how that was actively erased through the process of burning to create lime mortar to build buildings, to be the mortar between the bricks that built the first colonial buildings. And so there's this transformation that takes place to sort of substantiate or kind of embed a claim of history here in this place, even though it's a very fragile, young country. But also those structures, those shell middens, those large deposits of material that gained not only physical importance because of their scale, but also cultural value for the sustained existence. That was an urbanism. That was a city. There was a city that was here first, that was in Sydney first, and then it was turned into the city that we live in.
Joel, it's been an absolute pleasure to just throw these ideas around with you in public. Wishing you all the best in Castle, and I hope that you get fired up and you come back and you make more work.
Thank you so much for this conversation. It's really, really been so enriching and just so good to talk to Mob. Thank you so much, Daniel, because it's been great.
Joel Sherwood-Spring speaking from the Friedrichsianum in Kassel in Germany, the home of Documenta 15, where he's currently based. And Joel's work, untitled Winangara, was on as part of Ceremony, the fourth National Indigenous Art Triennial at the National Gallery in Canberra. That's it for the show this week. The Art Show's producer is Rosa Ellen, thanks to RN's sound engineers. Don't forget to follow us on the ABC Listen app. And next week, I'll be coming to you from up north in Darwin with a whole bunch of artist interviews and exhibitions to take you through. I'm Daniel Browning. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.